Welcome to Hot Yoga Radio. It's Sunday, the 28th of April 2024. It's quite a fine spring day up here in the hills, and I'm taking my constitutional. And I've just walked up through the woods, through the dappled light. And the trees have got a sheen of the lightest green of their first leaves. And it's rather sublime. Today I want to meditate on a painting, a famous painting. And it's a painting by Goya, Francesco Goya. It's entitled Saturn Eating His Children. And it depicts, well, the title says it all, but it's a very vivid painting of a monstrous being, naked, emerging out of some kind of void. Maybe it's water, maybe it's nothingness, maybe it's the black of night. So you see the three quarters upper part of the figure, and very frightening face, very muscled body, and he's clasping a human being, a naked human being, in one of his hands, and he's clearly just bitten the top, the head and shoulders off this being, and it's all bloody, and his face is all bloody, his face is wrathful. It's worthy of a Vajrayana depiction of a wrathful deity. It's a very, very powerful picture. The background is all—it's very dark, very black. It's a work of genius, there's no doubt about it. But also, this is the expression of a soul troubled by destructivity. Now, mythologically, Saturn is Kronos, time. And of course, time takes everything. It takes our lives, takes our civilizations, will take our planet, will take our universe back into itself. Of course, this is the insight behind the archetype of Kali, the wrathful goddess who devours all, devours her children, decapitates them, wears their heads as an ornament, wears their skulls as an ornament, drinks their blood. And of course, Kali, Kala, means time in Sanskrit also. So it's an insight that humanity has been awed by from time immemorial, I would think. In Goya's case, we have to bear in mind that the artist reported on the Napoleonic Wars in Spain, the Peninsular Wars, which were particularly horrific, with torture, rape, pillage, genocide, horrible, horrible, vicious war. And Goya documented this war with an amazing collection of etchings of the horrors. Got corpses hanging from trees being dismembered by soldiers with ugly grimaces on their faces, rapes, hangings, just every kind of torture you can imagine. And you can tell that it's prosecuted with a certain almost sexual joy, a joy in destruction, a joy in pain, a joy in the pain of others, joy and cruelty. And this is something we don't like to look at in our modern times. And if snowflake means anything, it means that, really. But of course we should, and now we have to. Our technology rubs it in our faces all the time. We don't have to wait for Goya to go back to his studio and process the etchings, the many etchings he did of the war. And in a time with very much more limited distribution of images and news and so forth than our own. Of course, it happens live now. You can see Dr. Jill Stein leader of the Green Party and presidential candidate in the US, being led off in handcuffs by the police for protesting the genocide in Gaza. You can see a philosophy professor being led off, handcuffed. You can see a black man being pinned down by police and then tasered after he's been pinned down. You can see it all. You can see it all. You can see the rubble of Gaza. You can see the satellite pictures if you want to. So there is a difference, but and yet, perhaps we're in the most denial. Because I don't want to give any credence to Pinker and these liberals who think that the world is getting better because of capitalism and markets and all that horse shit. But nevertheless, we've become a little bit less ready to display the jouissance, the joy of cruelty. I believe we need to look it in the eye. And of philosophers in the modern period, I can think only of Nietzsche, perhaps. I might be wrong about that, but Nietzsche certainly is one who took the trouble to analyse cruelty. And he analysed it in terms of will to power. In cruelty, one is allowed to exert some will to power over another. Will to power for Nietzsche is this ultimate drug. Of course, most of us are deprived of its use. It's reserved for elites. It's reserved for generals and political leaders and judges and torturers, state torturers. The normal person only gets a few little chances at it. But nevertheless, if you're deprived of the ability to express your will to power, you'll desperately find ways to get some of that drug. You'll want a homeopathic dose of it at least, and preferably a bigger dose. And I believe Nietzsche is correct about that. And he points out that way back in the old days, that a court festivity might have one of its sideshows, somebody being tortured or perhaps being flayed alive or something of that type. In a similar vein, I remember looking down into the oubliette at Warwick Castle, which is a very, very small hole in the floor of one of the state rooms. Very deep, very small, with a grill over it. And anyone who offended the Lord could be placed in this early bet and just left there to rot. And the people enjoying their revelries could, if they felt like it, go over and take a piss down the hole. And eventually, of course, that person would die and rot and smell the place out. And that was a thing for the powerful to enjoy the drug reserved only for them. A dose of the will to power. The dose to completely overpower, place another completely under his will and under his boot. Nietzsche also remarks, as we become more civilised, cruelty is repressed, sidelined, is made less respectable. We become embarrassed by it over time. So we no longer have public hangings. You know, you can see a retreat from it. Perhaps 150 years ago, you might see a child hung in public in London for stealing a loaf of bread. Now that child will get, I don't know, probation, £50 fine, whatever, you know. And we're a lot less easy with it. But nevertheless, it's still there. It is still there. And of course, we see in the case of Israel society, a whole population that actually is quite happy to be upfront about its cruel instincts and its vengeful instincts. And this is not to say that there's no (laughs) This is not to say they may not be able to make up some fairly reasonable sounding excuses, at least initially. But of course, what's occurring now has gone way, way beyond that. Unless you make the calculation that one Israeli life equals 5,000 Arab lives, or Palestinian lives, however you want to characterise these people. And it seems pretty clear to me, having watched interviews in Jerusalem conducted by Avi Martin, that a very, very good many, I don't know what proportion it would be, but I do believe it's a high proportion if we listen to polls, of Israeli citizens are quite happy about taking their dose of will to power in the form of cruelty onto others, quite unashamedly. So I think we need to look at it and we need to think, what do we do with it? We need to own it. It's a part of all of us. It is a part of all of us. And again, we witness it in the actions of the police, in the videos that are streamed right into our living rooms, into our telephones. In the US, and of course, we're going to witness the same thing in Europe. In fact, we're already witnessing it in Germany. And Goya, of course, having a thorough acquaintance with human destructivity and human cruelty, encapsulated it all in this masterpiece but terrifying painting, Saturn devouring his children. And of course, we are the children of time, but time will also devour us. And maybe therein lies at least one source of human cruelty, our mortality, our terror at our mortality. And maybe Freud was right, that one of the ways of dealing with the way in which it's already encoded in our being, that we will return to the chaos. Our psyches will return to nothingness. Our bodies will decay into compost. We'll be eaten by worms. And a way of coping with it is simply to be attracted to it, to play with it, to toy with it. Maybe to unleash it. And this, I believe, is the Freudian concept of the death wish or the death instinct. Thanatos, the god of death, Thanatos. The tendency of organised systems to return through entropy to chaos. The force of death in our lives as we live, which Goya documented, which the great tantric paintings of Kali wearing the skulls and drinking the blood have indicated to us, which nature managed to get a handle on by historically recording cruelty and drawing some inferences about it from his overall sort of quasi-metaphysical notion of the will to power as a primordial force. I think we need all of these descriptions and all of this art to get a head around it. So I think that this podcast, I hadn't really got all that much idea of what I was going to do as I came out the house, but I packed the Adirol thinking something's in there, and I just found myself thinking about that painting. And it sprang from there. As you know, for a long time I've wanted to complete my series on fascism with a final episode, which would characterise fascism as the weaponisation of the death instinct. So fascism, for all its horror, has actually produced some very able propagandists. Dr. Goebbels, Mussolini. I won't mention any of our homegrown varieties for fear of being sued, but you can see this kind of thing. And subliminally, and perhaps in a half-arsed kind of way, these people are able to grasp that the fear of death lurks in people, but also the fascination with death lurks in people as a concomitant of the fear as a concomitant of the sure knowledge of one's being devoured by Kronos, Saturn, Kali, Mother Kali, and that we will invite it. And certain individuals, you know, who engage in high risk activities, jumping out of aeroplanes maybe is a minor variety of this, but a toy with death. Junkies, heroin junkies, are notorious for this, you know, because the high is the brush with death, because this is a drug that can kill you. You can miscalculate the dose and die. And I know a number of people who've done that, including a young chap who died pretty well just a few yards from our house not so many years ago. He just took too much and there he was, dead on the grass. And this is a flirtation with death as well, you know. So it's a real thing, but certain people understand this, in a gut kind of a way, and they're able to mobilise it. And this is very useful to militaries, if they can mobilise their soldiers along these lines, if they can say, well, death before dishonour, you know, death from above. You will deal death, but you will also be exposed to death. Nothing is more glorious than to die for one's country. And of course, it's weaponised through what I call a jouissance, which is almost like a kind of sexual arousal, an orgasmic kind of joy around, well, first of all, as Bataille points out, breaking the prohibition, thou shalt not kill. Universal prohibition, thou shalt not kill. It's not easy for human beings, unless they are completely psychopathic, to kill other human beings. People who've done it very often don't recover. Even if they've done it by accident, they don't get over it. It's such a terrible thing. But some people can just do it. But if you're going to mobilise an army to exert power on a massive scale, on the scale of imperialism and conquest, you have to have soldiers who will embrace death to some degree, who will say, death before dishonour, I will die for my country, Valhalla, here I come. And this is a terrible nihilism. And what you see here is the political, military, cultural mobilisation of the death wish, which all comes out of our recognition of our mortality and our body's recognition that it's, as it grows, it is also hurtling towards death. As it repairs itself, it also breaks down. And we know that there are things in cells called telomeres, and their job is to kill a cell when it's worn out, not let it become cancerous in the process of aging. Just kill it, telos, take it to its telos, its end, a telomere. And these are active components of cells that can be activated by certain toxins and metabolic dysfunctions and so on, but also which are a part of the scenario. If your cells didn't die, you'd clog up and that would kill you. There has to be a kind of a homeostasis between growth and death, growth and decay. And our consciousness knows all this. Say, on the very surface level, we all go to funerals, we all lose relatives, and so on. We're all acquainted with it, it's knowledge, we know it. Our religions are full of a concern for it. And the shits who get their rocks off dominating the world, who are not able to deal sensibly with their will to power, with their drug addiction to the will to power, are quite happy to mobilise that on a very large and vast scale. And that's the mechanism of fascism. And we're seeing it very, very obviously and very, very large in our modern world. There's nothing new, though. In my lifetime, it's been written large many times. And I'm only slightly younger than the terrible events of World War II, the Second World War. And I am become death, said Oppenheimer, quoting the Bhagavad Gita, as Hiroshima was vaporised. as he saw the first the product of his favoured intellect tested for the first time, which again, you know, which then went on to, in single explosions, take out two quite large cities in Japan. So these weapons have been used twice, and in both cases they annihilated in one flash entire cities. So there's a lot of reckoning to be done for human beings, I think, because now the power of destruction is off the scale, completely off the scale. Mr. Putin's Russia has enough nuclear weapons perched on the top of rockets that can reach halfway across the planet. And he has enough to take out every American city of any reasonable size. But of course, vice versa. And that has been on the cards as a possibility, and now as an actuality since 1945. At the same time, nobody's dealing sensibly with their will to power, with their inherent cruelty, with the fact that their death jerks them around in life and jerks populations around, with the terrible, terrible fact that all this stuff can be mobilised for purposes of dominance, exploitation, and the accrual of more and more wealth into fewer and fewer hands, which in turn becomes the accrual of more and more power into fewer and fewer hands, as we've documented endlessly in this channel. That's where we're at, as far as I can say. Because will to power is a fascinating idea, and I do think Nietzsche was onto something. But he also showed us that there were many, many ways in which it could be satisfied, because it's not going to go away for individuals or for societies. I think we need to focus our will to power into feeding the world, liberating individuals in all societies to actualise themselves. And for bringing general prosperity to the people of the world and general security. This is a beautiful thing to do with our will to power. Our will to power exerts itself through technological advance, through scientific advance, through medical advance, and to my mind, supremely through art. That's what art is. Art's will to power. It's the will to power over materials. It's the will to power over your own psyche, over your own creative processes. It's the will to power which makes us wish to communicate and be understood and have our ideas understood and our suggestions for the human project understood. That's will to power also. And that's the direction to go in. And it's a bit of a tall order, it seems, at the current phase, but it seems to me, unless we get this sorted out, that it's game over for the human project, as far as I can see. I mean, we may limp on, but nobody's going to have a life worth fucking living. They really not. Okay, I think that's enough for now. So, lots of love, and make knowledge great again. Over and out.